Afternoon, friends. Good afternoon, friends. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host, Maria Hall. We have a special show for you today, and Maria is about to explain in what way that's true.
All right. How are you doing, Jim?
Not too bad. I've always got a little froggy in my throat these days, but he's happy, I'm happy, so we'll get through it.
All right. Well, we have a special edition of our show today. We'll be spending the whole hour in conversation with two environmental justice and public health advocates, Dr. Joseph Liu, President and CEO of Coalition for Clean Air, and Jane Williams, Executive Director of California Communities Against Toxics, about the environmental impacts of the LA fires and protecting our public health moving forward.
They do sound like great guests, and certainly I can't think of a topic more important these days, certainly not for the people of Los Angeles at any rate. So let's get right to it. Are they with us already? I hope they're already on the line, are they?
Yes.
Good.
Yes, Jim, I was just checking on Jane. So
let me get started.
Hopefully she will be here. I see Dr. Liu here. So
yes, indeed.
Yes. Well, it has been 3 full weeks since the fires in Pacific Palisades and Eaton Canyon started. When we woke up on January 7th, who knew the lives of so many of our friends and loved ones would be changed forever? Whether or not you were in the direct path of a fire, most Angelenos have been walking through the days since then through a cloud of confusion and grief, trying to offer solace and support where we can to those who have lost everything, but also knowing there's nothing we can really do to make it all right. And as the smoke clears now, we're hearing rallying cries to rebuild, 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 and rebuild fast. But what does that really mean? How fast and at what cost? Will environmental protections and hazardous waste cleanup be sacrificed for the sake of speed and the bottom line? Will the powers that be pause to take time to consider adapting to our more extreme weather so residents won't be as vulnerable to future disasters? And finally, what will be the price tag? Will new neighborhoods be accessible only to the wealthiest, leaving others who lost everything, including renters and peoples whose homes were inherited through generations, ever be able to afford to come back home? Well, the plans for LA's future are being sketched out now, in real time. To help us understand what's at stake and why it's critical for listeners to get involved, are two environmental science and public health experts whose true north always guides them to teach, advocate, and fight for the health of us all and our environment. First, we have Jane Williams, Executive Director of California Communities Against Toxics. Jane is an award-winning environmental health and justice expert. And we also have our friend, Dr. Joseph Liu, President and CEO of the Coalition for Clean Air, and a 12-year member of the South Coast AQMD Governing Board. And by the way, Coalition for Clean Air has hosted 2 incredible webinars on what we're discussing today. We'll give you more info on that in a few more minutes. Okay, Jane and Joe, welcome to the show.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yes, well, I'd like to start off with a question for Dr. Liu, Joe. Coalition for Clean Air sprung into action to put together webinars with experts and government officials to explain some very complex science to all of us non-experts. What's your main goal in getting this information out to the public?
Well, I'll just start by saying, the Coalition for Clean Air has a mission of protecting public health, improving air quality, and preventing climate change. And protecting public health is first and foremost in our mission for a reason. That's where our focus is. And Jane and I have been working on environmental health and justice issues for far, far too long, since about 1991 or 1992 is when I met Jane. And we've been working on them ever since. And so our number one priority was to protect public health. And we wanted to warn people about the toxic contaminants in smoke and in ash and the debris that was going to be left behind. And it's only because of the decades of work that we put into this that we had access to these experts and the relationships with these experts that allowed us to reach out to them and them to trust us to show up on our webinar and to explain to people what they need to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Jane Williams, hello and welcome to our show. LA is famous, of course, for its very diverse topography, geography, regions, microclimates everywhere. But we're all nevertheless still very interconnected, aren't we? Please explain, if you would, how the risk of exposure to toxins isn't confined by any particular street address or zip code.
Yes, thank you, and happy to join you this afternoon. So, because you've got the fires occurring in two places, not just one place, so Pacific Palisades, which is on the coast, and then more inland in Altadena, wind patterns, of course, were the blowing from the west, from the east to the west in the Palisades, but in Altadena, they were blowing from the north to the south. So if you look at the wind patterns and the contamination from both these fires, you're going to see like extensive ash deposition throughout a really impressive, area in the county, right? NOAA happened to be out on the ocean doing some monitoring of ocean water and, you know, basically measured ash going into the ocean 100 miles offshore. So you can see how far the ash can travel. Very, very, very extensive damage and traveling. And so one of the things that we are most concerned about is not just the diversity of the communities, but also these really susceptible subpopulations, pregnant women, small children, people with compromised immune systems, people who are already, you know, living in the industrial corridor along trade routes. Before the fires, California had some of the worst air pollution, you know, in the world, not just in the country or in the hemisphere, but in the world. And so you already have this susceptible subpopulation. And so the way in which you try to remediate the aftermath of the fires and you try to grate against, you know, disaster capitalism and try to maintain some sort of equity sets you up for this grinding political tension, which you can see has already begun. You know, the governor already basically said we are going to start suspending environmental and public health laws. Not like the fires were still burning, right, when he started making these pronouncements. And so you can already see, like, we've already basically skirted the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act in Azusa and opened up a, basically a hazardous waste storage and transfer facility without any public notice, without any public oversight, and with very little protection for the surrounding communities. Mm-hmm. So you'll see this. This is part of how our society responds to disasters. And unfortunately, that response often impacts those that have the least political voice and the most vulnerable among us.
Well, I'd like to hear from Dr. Joe Liu on that. Dr. Liu, Jane touched on this, but not all individuals are impacted by toxins in the same way, are they? Can you tell us what groups of people in our region are more at risk of increased pollution in our air and water, and historically, why?
Well, as Jane mentioned, you know, there are some about all the time. The very young, the very old, and those with compromised immune systems are particularly vulnerable to environmental health hazards. But what we also find, and has been found for decades now, is that when you look at the research, low-income communities and communities of color tend to have the worst air pollution. They have more hazardous waste facilities. They have worse air quality. They have more exposure to toxins, just generally. And this is why the environmental justice movement was created nationally and here in California, because of these findings and because of time and again realizing that those communities that are least well equipped to prevent the pollution end up with that pollution. There are exceptions. There's a pretty nasty landfill in Palos Verdes that I would put up against the worst of them all. But by and large, this is the trend. And as Jane also mentioned, we're all compromised because we breathe some of the most polluted air in the country. And so we have to be aware of that and have to be aware of the fact that we started off in a place with bad air quality and it only got worse for that time period in which those fires were burning.
Well, Jane, as Joe just talked about and you talked about earlier as well, to understand the risk of unhealthy air is especially challenging, isn't it? Partly because, or perhaps mainly because, we can't see what's in the air. I mean, and not as a rule. Oh, sometimes we see the soot and what have you, but that's only for a short period of time. We can't really know what it's doing to our lungs. Can you explain what kinds of toxins are in the air after the kinds of urban fires we've been experiencing lately, the magnitude of these fires, and how can we find out what the risks are on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, so yeah, we have a burgeoning understanding of what's happening during these urban fires because we did do some monitoring in some of the previous fires in California for air toxics. And, you know, what we have to be very concerned about are things like asbestos and silica and then heavy metals, polyaromatic hydrocarbons and dioxin and furans, which are all products of incomplete combustion, right?
You left off PCBs, Jane.
And I was going to get to that.
Okay, I knew you were.
You've got the PCBs, and now you have the PFAS. So PFAS is added to plastics, give it all these wonderful properties. And PCBs and PFAS are really in the same class of compounds as dioxin and furans. They bioconcentrate up the food chain. They end up in the polar bears. They end up in breast milk. And, you know, PFAS they're not an emerging contaminant anymore. Like, we have a lot of information. We know how they behave in the environment, and they are incredibly resistant to breaking down in fires. And so they just tend to get lofted, you know, all around, right? The PCBs, some of the transformers in Los Angeles still contain PCBs. And so if you had a transformer come off a pole, which my colleague Marty talks about, the act of God retirement policy for transformers. Most of the PCB containing transformers that were in place in the 70s, 50 years ago, when PCBs were banned, the production of PCBs were banned by Congress, are actually still in use. A significant portion of them are still in use. Huh. And so you have this whole potpourri of incredibly dangerous compounds. So if I went out into the air in Los Angeles, in the middle of downtown LA, and I took a grab sample of air, would I find PCBs in it? Probably very low levels, right? But if I'm in Malibu and, you know, a transformer came off the pole right down the street from my house, I could have PCBs like everywhere. So it's very localized, the impacts. And then this is also exacerbated by the fact that essentially, we have a don't test, don't tell policy on air toxics, not just in California, but across the United States. So, Maria, I know you have extensive experience with environmental law and policy, but I'm going to tell you something that you may or may not know. So right here in Palmdale, which is in LA County, NASA has an airplane. And that airplane is outfitted with some of the most sophisticated air pollution monitoring equipment in the world. And I have tried to get that airplane to fly many times to different chemical disasters during hurricanes, you know, in the Houston Ship Channel. And I can never get that thing off the ground when I need it. So is it possible for us to know what's in the air? Absolutely. Do we? No. And so you have to sort of ask yourself, well, why then? Right. So through the Build Back Better Act of Congress, we put extensive information. Sorry, did you have a question, Jim?
Oh, no. When you're done, I did have a brief follow up question. I was just letting Maria know that.
So we enhanced the available funding for local states and air districts to get access to sophisticated new types of equipment. And so in California 5 years ago, we didn't have that equipment. We do now. And so we have like five different units that are available in our state. I think two of which are in LA County right now that are mobile, that have the staff that know how to run them. And we could go and drive around Altadena and drive around the Pacific Palisades and tell you how much metal is in the air, how much, you know, VOCs are in the air. The equipment is very sophisticated. It has the ability to test in the low part per billion, high part per trillion range, but we're not doing that. So I think that these decisions that are being made, you know, to tell the public, hey, everything's good, get back to normal, your air's safe. It's like, well, wait, if I'm living next door, if I'm living next door to a pile of burned out cars and, you know, PCB transformers and people's homes with lithium ion batteries and ammunition, how can that be? I've gotten so many phone calls for like, wait, what? What are they saying? Right. And so that's another problem, is that there's no clear communication to the public about what's really going on. And most people sort of in their mind, they sort of go like, that doesn't make sense to me. How could I be living next to a burned out house and the sky is blue, but they're telling me I'm safe? Like, so I hope that answers your question, Jim. It's really don't test, don't tell.
Yeah, but I'm just sitting here sort of stunned. I didn't realize that every once in a while, you know, well, I read the New York Times every day. It'll often have what the unhealthy areas in various places around the country and so forth. So somebody's measuring somewhere. Whether that's adequate enough, another thing. But in other words, what you're really saying to our audience is that despite these horrific fires and the debris that we've all seen there and what has been released into the air, obviously, we don't know how much, really. And we don't really know what is safe and what is not safe. So the people of L.A., unless they're a hell of a long way away from it, can't really be sure where they can go and not encounter an undue amount of toxins in the air.
I mean, yeah, Jim, our problem, Jim, is that, and people are coming to appreciate this, air pollution is a complex issue. There's not just a single type of air pollution. So what we monitor for on a regular basis and a non-disaster basis, we use this air quality index, AQI, to measure. And it's really good at measuring what regional air pollution is like in your neighborhood. And you can rely upon that when it's a normal day. Right. And you've got a pretty good idea of, well, what's a problem, what isn't a problem. However, it doesn't cover what's going on locally. It doesn't cover what's going on with some air toxic contaminants or the type of air pollutants that aren't measured in the air quality index. And it really doesn't measure really large particles so well. And so there are some limitations to it. So you have to be aware of and careful to know what the limitations are of the air quality index. And then people get confused too, because, you know, there's a problem with ground level ozone, which is called smog, but we want it in the upper atmosphere because that's what's protecting us from climate change. So there's a lot of complexity to it. It has to be explained to people over and over again. And, you know, you get an appreciation for it, the more attention you pay to it. The air toxics policies that Jane's mentioning, our air toxic policy in California hasn't been touched in like 40 years. I think it was 1985 when it was when it was adopted. So we've learned a lot since 1985 about air toxics. And we need to go back and think about how we deal with this issue of toxic air contaminants, not only in disasters like this, but also just generally as policy.
Well, I also wanted to follow up with Jane. You mentioned a Build Back Better app, because we'll give information at the end, but I would love for you to say that for listeners who heard that right now.
The Build Back Better Act. So there's a few sentinel pieces of legislation that were passed by Congress in the last couple of years that relate to air pollution. One was Build Back Better, and one was the Inflation Reduction Act. And together, those two federal acts do a number of different things, but the piece I specifically was talking about was the Air Quality Protection Act, which was originally sponsored by Congresswoman Blunt Rochester from Delaware. And we wrote for that Air Quality Protection Act extensive pieces on enhancing the ability of the states to monitor for not just the five pollutants that are measured by the Air Quality Index, but and so that's, you know, one of the good things that came from the Biden administration was a significant amount, hundreds of millions of dollars of funding to do more sophisticated analysis for air toxics emissions. But I want to point out that trying to get people to understand why the air quality index doesn't measure the things that we really, really care about here is actually like, it took me a while to realize it, but we didn't use the air quality index to tell people whether or not to mask during COVID. Because the air quality index doesn't measure COVID. Well, the air quality index also doesn't measure asbestos and silica and metal. So you should put a mask on. Like, just that simple, you know? And if you don't know, then you should be careful because you don't know.
Indeed.
Right. And just to drive this point home, we have a colleague whose house burned down in Altadena. And his house was about 6,000 square feet. And the entire top of his house was covered with asbestos tiles because it was built pre-war. Oof. So just one house could emit as much asbestos as like blocks of asbestos, right? So like this is not an insignificant problem. And we saw this exact same problem and this exact same behavior post 9/11, where people said, oh, the air quality index, the air is fine. Everyone go back to your normal stuff. And now we have 138,000 people that are on the health registry. I can't even keep track of how many people we've killed post 9/11. And it's from many of these same contaminants, many of these same pollutants, exposure to these same pollutants.
Wow.
Well, I wanted to quickly go over to the subject of water before we come back to the fires as well. I'll direct this one to Dr. Joe Liu. Coalition for Clean Air recently gave a great webinar on the topic of water quality as well after the fires. Can you give us just a nutshell version and then let our listeners know how they can watch the webinar?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the second webinar we did, which was last Friday, we had Dr. Mark Gold, who is with the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. But everyone knows Mark because he spent so many years as the executive director of Gila Bay. He came on and talked about water quality issues, both drinking water and the water that's provided to our homes and businesses, and also the impacts on ocean water. And I would really defer to him and what he says. My expertise and experience, they all come from air quality issues. Mark is the expert on water, and that's why we had him on the second webinar. He relied heavily on studies that were done by a person who was on our first webinar, Dr. Gina Solomon. And the studies that she did in response to one of the big fires up north and looking at water quality issues that no one had really paid attention to. And what she found was that when there is such a draw on the water in the system, that it can create gaps where air comes in and the vacuum gets created and gets drawn in. Well, that air in the midst of those fires, when all the firefighters were fighting those fires, that gets drawn into the system can include all the air toxics that are in that air. And as Jane said, there's a whole host of bad ones. And one of the predominant ones that was found, that Gina Solomon found, was benzene. And it was not surprising when you realize how that occurs, because there's a lot of benzene in the air during these fires. So Mark talked about that, and he talked about the different water districts. There's 8 different impacted water districts. But one of the interesting things was after Gina's study, that California actually adopted a law that said if you have a fire of a certain size, I think it's 300 acres, and at least one structure burned down, you have to issue a drinking water advisory. And that's what these 8 different water districts were required to do. He talked about the difficulty of even figuring out what water district you belong to, especially if you're a renter and you don't pay the water bill. And he also talked about what's going to happen after this, the rains come, and this is before the rain the other day, and how the contamination that we find in the ash and the debris is going to end up running off into our oceans, and the precautions that people need to take from exposure to contaminated ocean water. So I would encourage people to go to our website, a Coalition for Clean Air. It's ccair.org, and you can find a link to that second webinar with Mark Gold. The first webinar where Gina talks about the water quality issues too is very helpful.
Yeah, Jane, ever since evacuation orders have been lifted in the Pacific Palisades and Eaton Canyon, many are now returning, understandably. These poor folks are returning to their properties to, you know, to see the extent of the damage and see if they can find anything at all to save from the wreckage and what have you. But from past disasters, what do we know about the dangers of allowing this rather hasty return to the damaged area without proper protections in place? I mean, it strikes me, based on what you've said so far, that that's not something that people should wisely do if they really care about their health. Or am I overstating the issue?
Nope, you are not overstating the issue, Jim. You hit the nail on the head. People want to return to their homes because it's about a return to normalcy. It's about safety. It's about security. It's about this really powerful emotional drive to return to where you were safe and secure. So, like, I understand that, and I understand the psychological imperative, and I've seen this play out at chemical disasters, you know, at huge fires, at, you know, chemical manufacturing facilities, you know, post-fire, post-East Palestine. I've responded to a number of different types of disasters, and you see this behavior a lot, you know, to the extent where some people are like, no matter how bad it gets, they are not leaving, or they're going back and they want to rebuild right away. And so there is this sort of sociological tension to heal the harm, right? Return to where you what you think is safe and heal the harm. Rebuild as soon as you can. So, but you have to, and it's extremely difficult to tell people that this place that was your safe and secure place is now harmful to you. It is just a psychological bridge too far. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really does come down to us, all of us as a society, like honoring that need and that want to return home, and honoring that need and want to find grandma's ring, find something to remind you of people that are, you know, either past or, you know, precious photographs, you know, parts of your family's history. There's a myriad of different things that people would love to recover from the ash. But the best way to honor yourself and your family is to stay healthy.
Yeah.
And so this tension, you know, is like, you need to have really good masking, put on a Tyvek suit, wear gloves, try to get like really thick soled shoes. You're walking into a construction site, like with nails and glass. And, you know, it's like, but it's really also really, really difficult because people are still in shock and they're traumatized by the fires. And if you lost your home, you're traumatized and you're in shock. And here's what happens to your brain when you're traumatized and you're in shock. Your executive functions decay. And so there's a lot of evidence now on a lot of different disasters over the last 20 years. And sociologists, you know, are writing about this and talking about it. Like, why do we see the same behaviors so consistently? And we see many of those same behaviors from our elected officials and our leaders, where like a series of bad decisions get made that put people's health at risk. And part of that actually can be explained by the trauma itself, with this decay of executive function, right? Mm-hmm. So, in fact, Jesse Dumiani at Urgent Futures just interviewed one of those psychiatrists. So I would strongly recommend that people watch that. That's the reason I tell people, do not make any decisions. Don't sell your property to a developer. Don't decide to rebuild right now. Like, you need to get past this shock phase and let your executive functioning return. You know, make sure you're in a safe place. Get that normalcy reestablished. But if people are telling you, like, put on a mask, whether it's public health officials, whether it's your neighbors or your loved ones, like, listen to that, right? Listen to these common sense measures to protect your health, right? Because it's just your house that burned down. Like, you don't want to take actions now where, you know, the 9/11 responders and all the 9/11 workers and all, you know, these people have so many regrets that they did not listen to their own common sense and say, I should wear a mask, right?
Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah, Jane, let me just add to that. I agree 100% with what you're saying. I do think, because I've been reading so much about these fires and the responses, that the one upside that I've noticed is that a lot more people now, thanks to what happened, you know, at 9/11, and thanks to what happened with other fires, and thanks to what happened in Lahaina and all these other disasters, people are a lot more sensitive now to the fact that that the smoke and the ash are toxic than they were before. So I think that message is getting out there. But again, you have to overcome that psychological barrier of just jumping in without taking those personal protective measures of wearing a mask and wearing gloves and the Tyvek suit and the shoes and the, you know, all that, all those things that you can do that will reduce your exposure dramatically. So try to let your rational brain take over a little bit.
Yeah.
Good decisions.
I can see.
Or if you can't listen to someone else's brain, it is rational.
Right. I can see why that would be the case. Well, let me just say, we're going to take, I guess it's almost right on time, a station identification break. But as a reminder, what Maria, I think, told you at the start of the show, folks, we're going to spend the entire hour today in conversation with these two good guests, two environmental justice and public health advocates, Dr. Joe Liu, President and CEO of the Coalition for Clean Air, and Jane Williams, Executive Director of California Communities Against Toxics. We're talking to them about the environmental impacts and the health impacts, if you will, of the LA fires and protecting the public health moving forward. So we're going to continue that after the break. Now a brief station ID and we'll be right back with you. Don't go anywhere.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Jerome Ellis on February 22nd at the Nimoy. The globally acclaimed Grenadian-Jamaican-American artist examines stuttering, justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Yeah, there we go. We're hearing our theme music again, so we're back with you, my friends. This is Jim Lafferty. You're still listening to the Lawyers Guild Show, and Maria Hall, my co-host, has put together an extraordinarily important show today, and so we want you to keep listening. We're talking about the fallout from the fires, but we're talking about the health fallouts, the environmental fallouts, and perhaps we'll get to why those places were chosen to be built in the first place and whether that was wise. But in any event, Maria, why don't you reintroduce quickly our guests and get back to it?
Sure. We are in conversation with two fabulous human beings who have been doing this work for a very long time, using their conscience, letting their true north be their guide to look at the environmental impacts and public health, what's going on with the fires, and moving forward as we, quote unquote, rebuild, because that rebuilding can take many forms, depending on who's making the decisions. And this half hour, we're going to continue that conversation. And we'll also let you know, think through this. I challenge all of our listeners to think how you can be part of shaping the policy that's happening in real time in the city right now. So now let's shift over to talking about schools and kids. I know there was a big press release, a big story out today about how many daycares were impacted by the fires. Are there best practices for public officials and school districts about when and where it's safe to let kids return to schools? I'd like to start with Dr. Joe Liu and Jane Williams. Please feel free to chime in thereafter.
Yeah, Maria, that's a great question. And obviously, our priority has to be the kids, who we want to protect them as much as we can. And, it's there is no easy answer here. And I don't know of any guidebook, regulation, you know, message that says exactly this is what you do and how you make these decisions. And I think in some instances, you know, the decisions are made for you. If your school burned down, you're not going back. You're going to have to be relocated. And I know that that's been done. And in other locations, you're so far from the fire that there might have been a little bit of ash the first day, and then they cleaned it up, and you can go back and you don't have a whole lot to worry about. It's those ones in between, and it's the ones that were close enough to where they were impacted by the fire, and there's a lot of residual smoke and ash and problems like that. And is it too close? Is it safe? Is it not? And you can only think and empathize with the parents who are stuck with these decisions, the school districts. And look, these school districts, they're you know, there's no conspiracy here. They're trying to do the best they can, and they're trying to protect the school children, and they're under a lot of pressure to try to you know, do whatever they can and do the right thing. You know, the one I'm most familiar with is Los Angeles Unified School District, because we've been working with them, and we actually established a particulate matter monitoring network for what's called PM2.5. We have more than 200 air quality sensors throughout the LAUSD district, and that you know, that monitoring network worked really well to let us know when the particulate matter was a problem in the fires. And I've been working with the environmental health and safety folks there for many years. So I have a bit of a, I think, a biased perspective on that. But I do know that, you know, during COVID, they went back through every school, every facility, every building, and they retrofitted those with at least MERV 13 or better filtration system. And the MERV 13 filters are some of the best that you can put in to filter out particles. Now, that doesn't filter out some, you know, the gases, which we might be concerned about. But I mean, at least they have those filters in the schools where they didn't prior to COVID, not all of them. And they have done deep cleaning of the schools, and they've hired independent industrial hygienists and contractors to you know, confirm that they're doing the right thing. But it's a hard decision. And one of the things that Jane and I started discussing, I think the day of or day after the fires began, was that some of these decisions aren't up to the schools. Some of these decisions, like where FEMA and EPA are going to put a giant pile of ash and debris, isn't made by the schools. And if that's next to a school or a relocated school site, then there's not much the schools can do other than to get away from it, or try to figure out how best to protect the kids under these circumstances. And there's going to be, you know, months and months, if not years, of cleanup activity going on, where hundreds of thousands, millions of truck trips, many millions of truck trips, perhaps, of debris and ash will be taken in and through these already impacted communities, and perhaps by schools. And if people aren't being careful to make sure that pollution isn't being what we call re-entrained, put back into where kids can breathe it or be exposed to it, then that we could have some real problems. So, you know, what can we do? We just have to take as many precautions as we can, try to protect the children, be aware of the problem, that the smoke is toxic, the ash is toxic, and minimize their exposures. Jane, you might probably want to jump in here too, because I know you've been working on these things.
Right, so we have local rules at South Coast Air Quality Management District on the contaminated soils, right? So we've got Rule 1466 that deals with contaminated soils, and Rule 1166 with VOC contaminated soils. And we've got Exide, right, which is one of the largest, most expensive cleanup sites in the country, right? And basically, that is a very similar type of cleanup. So we've actually learned quite a bit about how to prevent, you know, track out from trucks. How do you absolutely make sure that trucks are covered? You put a camera on it. How do you make sure that your contractors are not, you know, getting crazy and taking baths and lead contaminated soil? Oh, you put a third party monitor in place to kind of help watch the contractors, right? So we have a lot of experience both in the nonprofit sector and the governmental sector because of the Exide cleanup and other cleanups. The problem is we have a government, both a federal government and a state government, that are waiving requirements like that. And so, you know, I'm not sure what's going to happen when we start moving literally, you know, millions of cubic yards of what is essentially talcum powder. So it's one thing to like move dirt, and it's one thing to move cars, and it's one thing to move steel beams. But when you really, what you really are talking about when you're talking about removing the ash is managing talcum powder. And when you're trying to do that next to schools, next to daycare centers, next to people's homes and residences, it's going to get very challenging. And Rule 1466 is really a bunch of very common sense measures, like the drop height, you know, like don't have your bulldozer, you know, have a drop height that's way up here and you get a 30 mile an hour wind and you're trying to get that in the back of a truck. Right. Don't allow trucks to go down the street without tarps covering the loads. Right. Don't track out, you know, ash contaminated mud down the streets of Malibu or Altadena. You know, these things are, and, you know, there's perimeter monitoring requirements, and that rule applies to anything that's over 2 acres. Right. So we're not talking about measures that if you planned for them would slow down cleanup. And so what I really worry about is that because you've got this imperative from developers, from the president, from the governor, you know, you're putting these local regulatory agencies sort of like in this, you know, cow squeeze, you know, like just look the other way. Right. Yeah. And we've already got, for some reason, we've got, you know, truck beds filled of burned cars, you know, going up and down streets to the point where I've heard about it. People have called me about it. Like, is this legal? Are they supposed to be doing that? And some of our regulators have heard about it, right? Like, but how, you know, how many people do you think it's going to take to regulate that stuff on the ground between the Department of Toxic Substance Control, US EPA, and the South Coast Air Quality Management District? Like, you really would need like at least 100 people sort of driving around, you know, with a clipboard and watching out for these kinds of behaviors. And we don't, believe it or not, we don't have that kind of enforcement boots on the ground people, you know? So we are going to be very challenged by just the sheer magnitude of the civil engineering project to remove all the debris, the hazardous waste, all the cars, the steel beams, the construction debris, and then the ash.
Yeah. Then let me, that ties right in with what you wanted to ask you next, really. Assume for a moment that I'm someone who, if not right, and I may have been for this hypothetical, I may have been actually in Pacific Palisades or in the Eaton Fire. But the fact of the matter is, and therefore, or I'm close to it, I've lived close to it. So what would you say to me are some of the best practices for people like myself who want to make some good decisions about my health? Can you give us a range of options from the very minimum to the most protective that someone like myself should take then in lieu of what you've said and the kind of looseness with how this is all being cleaned up?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've given this advice to everybody that's called me and emailed me, and I've been on, you know, webinars with parents and late night Zoom calls, and I'm like, become a dust maniac. Okay? Like, think of dust like, wait, what's in that dust? Is that asbestos fibers? Is that silica? Is that heavy metals? Like, you basically at this point, now that the fires are contained, we've had a rain, everybody in that was impacted at all really should just like deep clean their house. Uh-huh. Like damp mop the ceilings, the walls, everything. Power wash the outside of your house. If you can't get a hold of a power washer, wash down your roof, wash down, you know, the exterior of your house so that you don't have these, again, silica, asbestos fibers, metals. And then don't wear your shoes in your house. Wash your dog's paws off. Wash your kids' hands often, 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 many times a day. Wash your hands. Your kids will be, oh, it's time to wash our hands again. Play a funny song while you're doing it. Because kids have this hand-to-mouth behavior, and that's one of the major routes of exposure with children is this hand-to-mouth behavior. And you're trying to intercept that, right? And don't let your friends come over. Don't let them walk in your house with their shoes on. I assume until all the ash and all this debris is moved, that your outdoor space can have a silica, asbestos, heavy metals, PAHs, dioxins, furans, PCBs on it. And that's the only way that I know to really protect people and intercept what are going to be exposures. Like, and when you're outside, wear a mask. If you're anywhere, I would say within, I'd say there's these zones, right? Like if you're in the ash zone, you're hot red. Yeah. Like you shouldn't be there without really very extensive PPE equipment on, right? Right. The irony, here's the irony. You have requirements from OSHA and California. So if you're a worker and you're there now at a burned out house and you're removing munitions, pesticide cans, lithium ion batteries, lead acid batteries, paints, solvents, cleaning materials, you have scuba gear on. You have self-contained breathing apparatus and you're completely covered in a suit. But I literally have a school that opened across the street with the kids playing on the playground and the workers across the street in complete, you know, level one PPE. So these are the scenarios. This is why we are so concerned about these decisions. Okay. For your own personal safety, you've got to get your house, your office spaces, your working areas really dust free, and then keep them dust free. Like damp mop. If you have carpeting, I tell people, I'm sorry, but if you're within like a couple miles of an ash zone, get rid of your carpeting because it's like a sponge for those contaminants. It's very hard to keep your house clean. Even, you know, every time you open the door, these fine particles are getting in your house. So those are some of the behavioral things that we can do to like intercept these exposures. But if you're living along a truck route, like let's say that they decide they're going to take the waste from the Palisades to Sunshine Canyon, right? And they're going to take it through like Topanga on the 27. Everybody living along that route, it's very hard to move talcum powder. Yeah. It's just, you know, think of it like talcum powder. Like, how are we going to manage this, right? So it's not good news, and we're you know, really we've got 2 years of this left, right? Like if you're in the ash zone, you're red hot. If you're within a mile of an ash zone, you're like orange hot. Within 2 miles, maybe you're pink, and then like even 3 to 5 miles, especially if you're along a truck route, you'll still see significant public impacts from the ash removal activities as they go on.
Amazing.
Wow. Well, it is sobering, but it's also necessary to have this information. Better to have it now and do what we can, what's in our power. So further on that topic of rebuilding, developers are chomping at the bit to take advantage of this moment when government regulations like CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which Governor Newsom suspended for burn areas. My jaw was on the floor. What are the benefits and risks of this plan of suspending the environmental regulations? Why don't we start with Dr. Joe Liu, and then Jane Williams.
I love the fact that you guys are the lawyers and you're asking two non-lawyers for the answer to this question. But I tell people all the time, I can't shake a stick without hitting an attorney. I am not an attorney. I'm not providing legal advice or anything like that. And in fact, what I've learned about this comes from the attorneys who work for CEQA Works, who are just wonderful people and do a great job. So I will promote them to the end of the earth. But, you know, they pointed out this is a false narrative that we have to suspend CEQA in order to rebuild. The replacement of existing structures and facilities is exempt under CEQA, right? The building of single family homes, of duplexes, of small stores, of small offices, exempt under CEQA. Right. Larger infill housing projects completely exempt under CEQA. You do not need to waive CEQA to do those things. And of course, CEQA is there It's a California Environmental Quality Act. We always refer to it as the acronym CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act. It is there so we make informed decisions about environmental impacts. Now, I mean, can it hold up projects? Absolutely. Would it hold up projects in this scenario? I'm not so sure. And so, you know, it's important that we pay attention to what the environmental impacts are and the things that we're doing at all times, whether you have to do CEQA or you're exempt from CEQA. But the thing that's really concerning is, like, building codes, you know, may be ignored. And these new building codes that we have are there for the very reason to do things like prevent houses from burning down, right? Those new codes are so much more efficient, some saving money and hardening structures against fires. We should not be moving forward by ignoring those, or we're just going to repeat what we've just been through maybe 10 years or 20 years from now or longer, but it would happen again. And then the bigger picture question, and the one that is frustrating, is that we're likely going to miss a huge opportunity to fix some very bad land use decisions that have been made in the past. And it's nearly impossible to undo a bad land use decisions. But when Jane and I first started working on environmental justice issues in the early 90s, you know, it was clear that there were some key things that were the problems with environmental justice. You know, there was lack of public participation opportunities. There were things like cumulative environmental impacts that were being ignored. But the other thing was the impact of bad land use decisions. And we spent many years trying to improve the policies that would help make for better land use decisions. And here we have, in some ways, a complete rebuilding of large communities that will not be done carefully and thoughtfully, because people are going to want to get their property back, their homes back, their buildings back exactly how they were. And I understand that. But we're also perhaps giving up an opportunity to, you know, make these communities stronger, more resilient, reduce traffic, solve some of the problems that are inherent in the sort of sprawl community that we have in Los Angeles. So that lost opportunity when it comes to land use is one that troubles me. But I think that might just be an impossible fight to have at this point, because people are just going to rebuild, and you can't blame them for wanting to do that. Mm-hmm.
So I would, you know, CEQA is not, it was very interesting what laws he chose to waive, right? It wasn't just CEQA, it's part of the Coastal Act too. So if you're going to do that, what I really worry about again is, are we going to start waiving the very same laws that help protect public health, right? There's clearly, like, huge environmental concerns about, especially in the Palisades. You know, this is like the fifth major fire that has hit the Palisades in the last, like, so many hundreds of years, right? Fires in the Palisades are not like, wow, no one could see that coming, right? No, everybody saw that coming. That's why the insurers pulled out. So it's not like, wow, we don't know that, you know, there's an environmental problem there. But like, specifically waiving CEQA, well, then how are you going to make decisions about, let's rebuild with hardening? Let's take down all the overhead power lines, which keep causing these fires. Wow, let's, you know, electrify a lot of these things so that, you know, you don't have the carbon footprint and the collateral damage to the climate. There's a lot of things that you could do with green building, you know, planning better for children and for schooling and for, you know, just all kinds of opportunities that now you're basically saying, no, it's the Wild West, right? So I really start worrying. One of the first public meetings, town hall meetings, was just held on the rebuilding of the Palisades. And what are people concerned about? That it's going to take so long to get rid of the ash. You know, people just, they want, if they had a magic wand, they want that ash gone now. And, you know, trying to explain to people that there's phase one, then there's phase two, and that the reason that you don't want a guy in a bulldozer on your property is because a significant portion of homes have stored munitions on their properties. So, like, you already got this impetus that's partly from property owners and partly from developers. Like, let's bulldoze public health protections while we're bulldozing environmental protections. And so that's what I am very concerned about, because I've seen it happen so many times at both chemical disasters and in fires too. And amazingly about sending kids back to school in ash zones, in fire zones, in, you know, where chemicals are still everywhere after a chemical disaster. There's this like amazing societal norm to send kids back into harm's way that I still don't understand. And you put parents in a horrible situation of trying to say, I don't think my kid should go to school here. And, you know, then like the school system saying, oh, well, if you don't send your kid, like, you're just going to give their seat up, you know, and you gotta figure out yourself where your kid's going to go to school if they're not going to go here. So, like, that's already played out with other schools. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I'm so sad that we can't continue, but we will have you on again, please. And in this last minute, please let us know how people can learn more about your work and how can they get empowered.
Well, the best way to empower people, I would say, is, you know, keep listening to the Lawyers Guild show and keep listening to KPFK, donate to KPFK and support it, the great work that they do there. You want to get involved, just jump in, get involved. Know you have a First Amendment right to redress your government for grievances. You can support Coalition for Clean Air. You can go to our website. You can support, California Communities Against Toxics. Know who makes decisions and your rights to influence them, and just get involved. That's the way to do it. Just get involved.
Jane? Same thing. I'm with Joe. The organization and my motto is, if you see a good fight, get in it.
I love it. Well,
so there's a lot of good fights here. If you're a parent, if you're an educator, if you see trucks going down the street with toxic ash blowing out the back, call 1-800-CUT-SMOG. And Joe's got a listserv you can join there that's going to push out lots of information about fires. And there's lots of opportunities to stay informed and stay involved.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Well, I thank you so much. You've given out so much wonderful information. We really do thank you both. Mm-hmm. We say to our audience, we hope you've enjoyed. We hope you take the advice that you were given today so that you stay safe. Until next week, same time, same place, we'll be back with you at the Lawyers Guild Show. Until then, do stay healthy, my friends. And as the song is about to tell you, don't stop standing up for your rights.
Stand yep. up for your right.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up. Fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
I'm Sergio Melnyshenko with the Global Village. Join me Fridays at 11 a.m. with music from around the world and around the block, as well as some very special interviews. Fridays from 11 to 1 p.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, also streaming on kpfk.org.
Chimarenga. Join us at the Liberated Zone of Freedom Now every Saturday from 11 to noon for a Pan-African perspective on world affairs in a fly music mix. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
We in the cut. What? We in the cut.
Los Angeles, Southern California.
Cab. We going up.
That's right. It's In The Cut Radio, live from the launch pad with DJ Ben Vera, every single Saturday night, early Sunday morning, midnight to 2 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, right before All of the Above Radio. It's the best way to spend your weekends, y'all. Don't you miss it. And away we grow.